Hi, all. These are generally conversations between adults after the children have left the table. The language can be spicy, and the subjects can get saucy. So if you're ready, this is the Southern Fork. Unscripted kitchen chats, and also studio chats, with some of the most interesting voices in the culinary South. I'm Stephanie Burt, a food and beverage writer based in Charleston, South Carolina, who travels with her fork to write for a variety of publications, from magazines you might have on your coffee table to the website you love to visit for your favorite recipes. And I'm inviting you to come behind the scenes with me to get to know the people who make this Southern culinary landscape so special. I'm always hungry for the next bite, thirsty for that next sip, and ready for the next conversation. Let's dig in. The Southern Fork is honored to be presented again this year by Townsend Automotive in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. Celebrating 50 years of service in Tuscaloosa and West Alabama, the Townsend family of dealerships has been a locally owned company built on service and connection with its customers. At Townsend Honda, with new cars in short supply, they've purchased more than 200 quality pre-owned vehicles. And every one of them goes through a 118-point inspection before it's offered for sale to you. Most of those vehicles are either Honda-certified pre-owned or Townsend-certified pre-owned, and the dealership also has a fully staffed parts and service department to assist you beyond the purchase day throughout the life of your vehicle. That includes Saturday service, which is available until 1 p.m., even during football season. Visit TownsendHonda.com for current inventory, or if you're in West Alabama, stop in. Townsend Honda salutes local entrepreneurs, from restaurateurs to podcasters, and they welcome you to be part of a community that does the same. Sitting high atop a hill with a view of the scrubby brush and low oaks of the rolling landscape of Central Texas, Southhold Farm and Cellar seems a long way from Long Island, New York. But less than 10 years ago, that's where this winery was located, with wines from winemaker Reagan Metter filling the glasses of New York City and getting celebrated in hotspots ranging from Gramercy Tavern to Roberta's in Brooklyn. After repeated zoning struggles, Reagan and his wife and co-owner Carrie relocated the operation out to Fredericksburg, Texas. And Reagan, a Texas native, began learning how to graft his thoughtful style of winemaking with what nature hands out in this region. What has resulted is some of the most exciting wine to come out of the state yet. Interpreting the unique landscape, soil, and weather conditions into a sense of place in every sip. It's dynamic, it's interesting, and of course, delicious to drink. Welcome to the Southern Fork.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Yeah, it's me too, because I got wine. Y'all, can you hear that? That's right. I'm so excited to be here. I'm actually looking out at the most amazing view. The hill country is such a different landscape for me. I love to come out here. I like to eat. I like to drink. But it really wasn't until this time, this visit, that I really thought about the environment, and it comes through with wine. And wine is number one farming. Wine is thinking about the soil mm-hmm. and things like that. Coming from Long Island, coming from that environment and here, can you talk to me about the first time you got really excited, like when you tasted a grape or knew that, like, we're going to be able to make good stuff here?
You know, I mean, to be perfectly honest, I had been coming back to Texas because that's where my family was still living and still does live here. And so I had the chance to kind of watch this industry in this generation that's started recently, get its start. And it was with that started to open my eyes and to the idea of growing grapes in Texas and making wine in Texas. And when you start really looking at it through that lens, you start to see things that get winemakers excited as far as soil structures go, the amount of limestone that we're sitting on, the topographies.
Which I can look out and see. Yeah, there's limestone in that soil based on that environment.
And it changes too. I mean, we've got, just right down the road, you have the Llano uplift. It's literally a line that demarcates from white limestone-rich soils to red granite soils. And I mean, it's not a gradual thing either. And having that in just this close proximity means that we're going to have a lot of material to work with the further things go along.
Now, I was explaining to somebody, because somebody that we were tasting with was like, why are you looking so excited? Why do you like these wines? And I said, well, there are really two ways of making wines. You can, if you think about it as dressmaking, you can try to make it to an industry standard, mm-hmm. like that standard size 8. So you're trying to make it that way. Mm-hmm. Or you can custom make clothing to a body. Mm-hmm. And there's validity in both of those approaches.
Sure.
But you're the latter. Is mm-hmm. that a good way to kind of explain
it? I think that's
it?
I hadn't actually ever given it a thought in that manner, but in a lot of ways that is, in the sense that, you know, the grapes that we're getting is kind of the body in this case, and
mm-hmm. right.
we're making the wines based off of what we're getting, you know, rather than you trying to hit certain production schedules and things like that.
And also flavor standards,
right,
because
right.
anytime, it's kind of like when you're going to the grocery store and you've got that one cucumber mm-hmm. and you're hitting that cucumber and it needs to taste like
it has to look
a general
right, right.
way, versus having a short pickling cucumber pulled out of the garden and eaten.
Right.
So,
right.
Southern Fork listeners, you're going to know I like the latter at this point. That is intentional and it takes work. It takes work either way.
Well, it's scary too, not to lie. I mean, you know, we're sitting in a vintage right now in 2022 that is polar opposite in the Hill Country from 2021. You know, I'm probably going to put two wines with the same name out, and one is a big dark red wine from 2021, and from that same vineyard, this vintage is going to be a rosé. And
wow.
that's just because of the weather that we had and what we were seeing in the vineyard and what we thought it was, you know, going to need, you know, from a standpoint of the ripening cycles and things like that. And so to not be able to make, you know, the big red wine for some people, I think is terrifying. But I think it's going to be an exciting thing to see, you know, wines from two different vintages from the same two parcels next to each other and be able to see what's similarities and what's the differences. And that's where you start to understand what makes this place unique. What are the flavors and stuff that we are producing?
Because the flavors that you're producing are literally coming from the soil through the grape.
Mm-hmm.
And that intention, that idea of saying, I'm going to let the body decide the style
right.
instead of the style decide the body. This feeling that is so hot in wine right now, people hear intentional wine, natural wine, and you were just saying in the tasting, you like push away from that.
I'm pushing away. It's the marketing aspect of all of that I tend to push away from. Some of my favorite wineries are quote unquote natural wineries, but it's not about them being natural that makes them great. It's the wines that they're making ultimately that make them great. And for me, that's the important aspect of it. I don't want the process to be the thing that you're buying. I want the product and the end result to be the thing that is making you want to buy our wine. So that's a lot of why I demur when the natural wine label gets thrown around, you know, not to mention all of the other aspects of that whole conversation.
Well, that it really doesn't mean anything
right.
in our particular AVAs,
right.
with domestic AVAs. It just
right.
doesn't mean the same.
Natural in this country versus natural in that country, all of these things. It just, to me, ends up being more confusion. And then the thing that we've really kind of landed on for us is talking more about transparency. You know, everything that we do, every vintage to each line we put on our website, it's our labels are such that there's not a lot of room for that kind of thing. But it's all under a folder on our website under Thoughtful Winemaking. And that's kind of the idea, is just if the wine industry had been transparent, you know, 30 years ago, there really wouldn't be a natural wine movement.
There wouldn't be a need for a natural wine movement, is what you're saying.
Right.
But we're talking about bags of acid being added in to make it even. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that's happening. The reason why some wines only cost $4.99.
Right.
There's a reason for that.
Right, right. You're taking...
And that doesn't mean that your wine... By the bottle, I'm looking at a wine that's $30.
Right, right. I mean, and then it's not to say one is necessarily right or wrong, but for me, if we're getting into a place where we're having to do a lot of manipulation and changing of the thing that we're actually working with, like our main ingredient, then to me, that's a big sign of we're not doing something right in the vineyard. We're not working with the right varieties. We're not. And so for me to put Texas on the map, we have to move away from this idea that we have to fit a certain idea or category of style of wine and start to really come through and see what things do work and don't work and don't require a lot of fixing, so to speak. And so that was the big thing. And honestly, that was the big thing when we were in Long Island. And it's a big reason why we kept the name the way that we exactly what we did, because while our place changed, like, what we had set out to do from the outset never changed.
Right. And so there's a humbleness that has to be there, right? There,
yeah.
I mean, as a in a way, this is a scientist, you know, you're experimenting and you have to be, open to the hypothesis being disproven.
Right.
Right.
I mean, it's not very different than even what chefs do either. The difference being that I only get one crack at it a year versus tossing out the thing and starting all over again, you know? And so that aspect of it does make it a lot more scary. I mean, just by numbers, I don't have a whole lot of vintages left to keep trying, you know?
But in Texas, you know, it's the stepchild of American wine. And I think I can say that.
It's the, maybe a stepchild, maybe just a forgotten child.
Yes, yes. Well, I'm from originally from North Carolina, and there are other conversations we can have as well.
Right.
But I'm not going to have those because I'm not trying to be evil.
Right.
But winemaking has a long lead time. It takes a long time to learn because the environment, the process is slow, all of those things. And so we can say, you know, do you have a chip on your shoulder, blah, blah, blah. I'm not going to ask that question.
Mm-hmm.
Does not having the same expectations give you freedom to do different things?
You know, that's a lot of, you know, discussion, especially when we first started out, not having the background in school and coming from the wine business. I came at things, I think, from a much different place than a lot of people do. And I didn't have the chains of you can't do this or you should do that kind of thing holding me back. And so, you know, earlier on, I think I even probably took it a little extreme and pushed really hard back at the industry and that kind of what was going on. I tend to have that challenging nature in me. But, you know, ultimately, I learned from that side just as much. And I'm sure too that the people that, you know, I've had as neighbors and colleagues have learned from me as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, complacency is the main thing, the main evil here. And when, as a region, whether it's Long Island or Texas, when we get to this point where we figured it out and it's just what we do, that's a scary point to me. And so having or even needing to be that person that questions or pushes is important. And so not having the expectations, so to speak, was definitely nice.
And you can also I mean, like, if you wanted to just kind of chill, you could make money because right. there are buses of people coming in right. to drink wine in Fredericksburg right. every day. No. And you don't have to worry about it. Right. You could just be like, let's just make some wine and pet our dogs and drink some wine.
My wife will tell you, I definitely make things harder than they need to be. I like that path of the untraveled path, so yeah. to speak. And yeah, we've made a lot of bad choices.
Well, one of the things that I think is so interesting about your wines being in Texas, comparatively speaking to a lot of other wines, and Southern Fork listeners, I'm a baby in wine. I mean, I know more than the average bear, but that's not really saying that much. Mm-hmm. But Texas wines are big and bold. I mean, they
have that's the expectation.
That's the expectation. Right. That's right.
Right.
And that's what I'm saying. You know, this idea of like these big reds right. and this like, you know, Italian villa on the edge of 290 and you're just right. like gonna. Right.
The castles.
Yeah. And, you're yes. just gonna have this thing. And here it's very modern, but your wines are really balanced. They're very fresh. And I mean, like talking about the Skin Contact Trebbiano, which I'm not drinking right now. I'm drinking a blend that includes that, but it stops before it needs to. Like it could have gone a little, you know, like orange wine is a new,
right.
newer category to American drinkers. Right. So you can be a little sloppier with that.
Right.
So it's balanced. It's beautiful. It's got orange blossom.
I see what you're saying. Yeah.
See what I'm saying?
Because people don't understand.
There's a little restraint right. there. And there's right. a restraint in the space and a restraint. And you called it freshness. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's kind of German to call it restraint.
Right, so right. Fair.
But there's that space and that style. Mm-hmm. Do you think that that's just your natural way of creating wines? Is that something that you did in Long Island, or do you think that the landscape has
dictated? No, I mean, balance has always been a big deal for me. And you know, it's not that we hit it out of the park every single time either. Obviously, there's a learning and seeing how wines age and things like that. You know, we don't unfortunately come from either places really where we knew exactly how the wines were going to turn out. You know, Barolo knows how long they need to age each of their bottles for.
Right.
This is all still a little bit making it up as you go. And so you have to control a little bit of the variables. And so I look at our winemaking as, you know, not swinging for the fences every single time and not pushing things to the extreme necessarily. So, you know, in the case of like a Skin Contact Trebbiano, we're not aging it in amphora for 50 days or whatnot. You know, it's you know, about 3 weeks of fermentation, and then we put it into wood. And so it's very simple. It's really so that we can track that too. You know, we don't have all these different variables that might have influenced, because that's hard to learn from.
Right, right. Back to the Trebbiano, that kind of grape. And I've been to a few wineries here, and you know, everybody says this is kind of our focus.
This is the grape of Texas.
Yeah, this is the grape of Texas. You
it's
know,
like the grape of France.
And I'm kind of like, cool.
Yeah.
And then I go to the next one. I'm like, wait, I thought it was that one, but it's not. It's right. this one. When you're deciding, because you said you contract with farmers and who farm the way that you want to farm, and then mm-hmm. you work with them. And I work with chefs all the time that say, I want to work with a farmer, and then we figure out what we're going to grow,
right?
Kind of thing. So there's something that turns them on, and then they develop a relationship, and it gets deeper mm-hmm. from there. How are you choosing the grapes? I mean, I know that's like, I don't know, a book.
Right. No, well, I mean, there's some thought to it. And also, too, when we first got out here, it was kind of a cornucopia. They've got so many different varieties that are getting planted here, and everyone's trying new things. And it was just like, where do you start?
And you also have to wait like 5 years right. before you know if it's good. So you right. kind of have to have some future kind of ideas.
And for us, you know, while we're waiting, as we're developing our vineyard, it was important to find people that grow the way that we want it, things to be farmed. And so that wasn't an easy thing to find either. It took us a little while. We've got lucky with a few places here in the Hill Country and the High Plains that took a bit. And not to mention, you know, I had to build a team in the cellar to trust, because that's a 5-hour drive. You know, it's, you know, making Southern Rhone wines in Burgundy, essentially. And so it's important that I'm at almost actually every single one of those picks. And I'm out there checking on the vines. You know, we borrow a friend's press up there and process the whites up there rather than bringing grapes down here. There's all these little things that we've just kind of learned, and having those relationship with those growers and knowing that we can trust them, and, you know, they all live on their farms. That's a big, important thing for me, because that's, you know, a guy that's living there with his kids isn't going to go out and spray a bunch of
Good point.
Right on his front yard. Those kind of things really were important. And second to me, because I don't know the answer to it, is the grape varieties. The big aha moment was Gruner Veltliner, for instance. You know, that's a variety that I would have laughed in your face if you'd have told me I was ever going to touch in Texas. And it's become...
It's fussy.
It's fussy, but it's nowhere near a hot climate.
Right.
And there's not to say that there aren't issues with it being in a warmer spot, but the fact of the matter is it's going to have characteristics that are very different, and that doesn't make it any less than. And to me, that's the real special thing, and the thing that I'm looking for the most is finding varieties that people might know and be very comfortable with that tastes completely different than what they're used to, because that's really what makes wine special. And that's
Really what makes it anchored in place.
Right.
It makes it taste like the place. I mean, this is not an easy landscape for grapes to grow. And obviously grapes grow, I mean, wine is best when the grapes are stressed, but.
Right. I mean, the interesting thing about that though is, you know, grapevines themselves really do like it here. And in particular, like on our hillside, there's a couple of things. I've got so many native varieties up here. One in particular called Berlin D'Aria, which is one of the main parentages of rootstock that's planted all over the world. It's used in places that are hot and dry and have, you know, alkaline soils. And I can't get rid of the things. They're prolific here. And so grapes do want to grow here. Getting fruit to that point of making wine is the tricky part. And that's, I think, the thing that held back Texas for so long. You know, you talked about how Texas is big red wine. That's because that's what Texans drink. And that's, you know, like
really amazing point.
Right.
That is a really amazing point.
Right. California would go out of business if Texans stopped drinking Californian wine. I mean, and what happened was a lot of guys came out here in the 80s and 90s, wanted to have a vineyard and planted Cabernet, made the wine and realized, I can't make Napa Cab. And it was honestly unfortunate for them. They were living in a time where people were like, if it doesn't taste like my Napa Cab, it's not good. I'm lucky enough to be able to put out to put out a cab that doesn't taste anything like that, that I'm in love with. And that to me is a special thing. I have a hard time describing it. Is it, you know, claret? Ish Bordeaux, is it?
It tastes like a Texas Cabernet.
Right.
Instead of a Napa Cabernet.
Exactly.
And that's what you're doing, is you're building that taste lexicon.
Right.
Right. In
that's
Texas.
Absolutely right.
And in order for a wine region to actually mature, you need to have that building.
Right.
And it doesn't happen overnight.
It doesn't happen overnight. And if we don't, you know, the thing that keeps me up at night is not having that definition of Texas wine, because why does it need to exist? Why does Texas wine have to exist? It doesn't if we don't give people a reason. It's not because we have a tasting room and it's a fun place to come and hang out.
Yeah.
I mean, people can sell California wine on 290 in their tasting room if that's the case. It's a lot easier. So for us to find that thing that's unique and special is, and prove to the world that it's worth their while, is the main thing that we're here to do.
Mm-hmm. And it's fun while you're getting there.
Right. Oh, yeah.
It's also like frustrating.
I mean, this is to not be having fun in this business. It's too stressful and too much to do other. I mean, you just do something else.
Yeah, because when people say I don't manipulate the wine much, it means that you just sit by and sweat.
That's the thing. It's a lot of the times you hear guys talk about it, is like, oh, do nothing wine making. It's like, it's kind of the opposite of that, to be honest. But, you know, suit yourself.
Yeah. Well, you've already answered one of my final questions, what keeps you up at night. So I'm going to go ahead and ask you, what's making you hungry? I mean, you're making some really phenomenal wine. Not, and I'm doing the air quotes, just for Texas.
Right.
I mean, this is great wine.
Thanks.
And so what's next? What are you interested in?
I mean, you know, the big thing that we've been working on is getting our own vineyard up and running, 13 acres. We've experienced a lot of highs and lows with it. And when you're planting vines on the side of a steep slope like we have, and that doesn't exist here, we're kind of making it up as we go quite a bit. And, you know, we've had some tough vintages, especially this last year with the drought and wells drying up or losing steam. And so it's definitely pushed us back, but the really cool thing is seeing how well the vines still kind of hold on. And so I'm hoping, you know, in the next 2 or 3 years that we start to put more and more estate wines out, which will be very exciting.
Yeah, it's a different level.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different level. Okay, what's one aspect of this job that your wife thought you would just get out of your system for 6 months? But what's
right.
one?
She thought this whole thing was a lark.
She's like, "Can you get over this?
Right,
we got to move on with our lives." But what's one aspect of it that really just meshes like a puzzle piece with an aspect of your natural personality?
I mean, that was the thing. I never, when I got into this, it was one of those things I thought that it was just going to be a couple of months. I would work a harvest and, you know, thumbs up, I cross that, check that box. But getting in there, it was just everything clicked. And there's so many aspects of this that you, so many different parts of your brain that you have to use. There's the artistic side, there's the left brain, the right brain, like all of that. And then even running the business, I mean, we're a farming operation, we're a manufacturing operation.
Completely factory.
Hospitality, yeah. Distribution. I mean, it's all over the board. So it's daunting at times, but I love that it every day is a new challenge and something completely different. So, mm-hmm.
And that challenge, when you're saying the drought really affected you, are you irrigating or are you following the European model?
So the first, I think it was first year, 2 years, we didn't irrigate the vines and they were alive and they were doing okay. And this is just when they were rootstock. And then we grafted them over and just started to see some things struggle. And so we decided to just get out irrigation. We don't have a big enough well, I think, to ultimately irrigate them and keep them alive that way. But this is just to get them to build more root structure. Ultimately, the goal is to dry farm the vineyard. And so we're just, you know, going at it a little bit more methodically. So, you know, it's a slow process.
Well, since you answered my keeping you up at night question, I want you to answer this if you can, or speak to this, I should say. Intention is very important in winemaking, but it also extends to your business, and your business has a community presence. It has, a point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that important to you? Because you could be apolitical in wine if you
right.
wanted.
Right. You know, the political thing is a tricky place here, and we live in that space between blue and red.
That's right.
Very bright shades of each of them. And trying to facilitate those conversations and even be a translator of such.
Right.
I think is probably one of the more important things that we should be doing. And so, you know, we engage with everyone that we can and our neighbors and just even winery owners. I have very differing opinions with and things like that, but it's important that we all are still operating together and working together and building that community. I mean, that's the big thing for us. You know, we're still pretty new here for, you know, what is considered a local. So we're making our way through.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I would say that I maybe misspoke when I said political, because I think a lot of the things that you champion are really just human issues, human ideas, human focuses. The adding of politics to really human condition is doesn't serve us.
Right. Well, and I think, you know, that's the thing, is what's been so surprising is how much common ground there actually is when you actually
take away
all of
some
that.
Things that are noise.
Right.
Yeah.
And things that are meant to polarize, you know?
Like, absolutely.
And so
monetization of divisiveness.
Right, right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, you know, for us trying to balance that and be a place where everyone can feel welcome is kind of a pretty important aspect of it.
All right. I'm going to ask you the question that I reserve just for Southern Fork guests. And that is, I would love to put some of your favorite things in a picnic basket. Mm-hmm. So, this is a dream meal scenario kind of question. As eaters, as taste lovers, as travelers, that's going to change. So this is just today.
Right.
So I can time travel.
Like, what time of the year is it?
So I can time travel. I can cook a little bit. I can ask somebody to make just one more bite of something that you love, that you would love to try again. And I'd love to just put some of that stuff in a picnic basket. It doesn't have to go together. Like I say often, guests sometimes will do all meat or all carbs, and somebody did all beverages, and I was like, do you want to eat anything? And they're like, no, I'm good. So this is, instead of a death row meal, some things that would bring you life. So what can I put in that basket?
This is kind of funny, and I don't know why it popped into my head, and I hope that I don't get too emotional here, but I've been thinking about this lately. My mom used to make this thing called hot dish. You know, everyone's had something like this, where it's like, you know, macaroni noodles, some ground beef, a can of tomatoes, and some Velveeta cheeses, like, and a few other things that she would add in there that I still haven't quite figured out what they were. Haven't had that in a long time. My mom passed away in, I guess it was, you know, 2017, right after we moved here. That would be one of them. I don't know why I was thinking about that today, but I was all morning. And some white burgundy.
White burgundy with hot dish?
Yeah. It honestly sounds perfect.
Honestly, you just need a whole 9x11 Pyrex casserole dish of hot dish.
Yeah.
And a white burgundy.
That's kind of what's on my mind today.
That sounds so awesome. Well, if people want to learn more about Southhold Cellars, you can go to thesouthernfork.com. I'm going to have links there. I'm going to have images so you can see the face behind the voice. Also, this beautiful wine in beautiful glasses. Their labels are gorgeous too. If you like what you hear, there is more wine content today in the Southern Fork than it ever has been. And so I appreciate you following along my personal journey, as I'm a food writer and a beverage writer. And I want to let you behind the scenes in the kitchen, and in this case, upstairs from a kitchen in a private tasting room. So thank you so much for chatting with me. Hello and welcome to Talking With My Mouthful. As you can probably tell from this episode, I'm pretty enthusiastic about wine at the moment, but I have so much to learn. I've started my education, actually I started this time last fall, by taking classes with Sarah O'Kelly at Edmunds Oast Exchange in Charleston, South Carolina. If you follow along on my Instagram stories and you've been around for a while, you might have seen those pop up on the stories this time last year. I was planning to take the level one of the Court of Master Sommeliers test, and I've since changed that to the WSET level one for various reasons, but I haven't taken the test yet. I got a little overwhelmed, but even though I have just begun my education on wine, I really want to suggest that if you like sipping wine, that you take some classes too. You find a bottle shop in your area that does tastings or does classes, education classes. It's a wonderful way to not only enjoy more of what you drink, but you kind of travel through the class because wine is about regions. It's about geography. It's also about farming. So all of that stuff is a great place to really dream if you can't just hop on a plane every other week. And even if you don't get everything that you're supposed to get out of each class and you're not retaining all the information, you will retain more than you think you do just because you're actually engaging in a multi-sensory experience. So you're not just reading about wine, you're hearing somebody talk about it, which is auditory, and you're also tasting, which of course is another sense. So this is going to really help your recall, but it's also going to help you learn what you like to drink and what tasting notes you're really attracted to, and you'll have surprises. So it's not necessarily about impressing your friends at the restaurant and being able to order something wonderful or feel fancy. It's more about figuring out your own palate and exploring what new flavors are out there that you might not have been exposed to yet. So thanks so much to the staff of Edmunds Oast Exchange. Also, so many other sommeliers through the years who have given me education and pointers, and suggested that if I like it, then I dig in. And that's exactly what I've done. You know, I'm a nerd and I love to learn, and there's nothing better than experiential learning. When it comes to wine, come on, how good can that be? So cheers. Thanks for listening. And I will be right here next week.
You've been listening to The Southern Fork. I can't wait to bring you more culinary conversations, but in the meantime, I have one question. Are you going to eat all that?